A powerful earthquake strikes off the coast of Taiwan.
It started shaking left and right first, and then it started shaking a little bit up and down. It lasted much longer, almost 2 minutes, and things started falling off the shelves of in my apartment. So I immediately practiced the protocol of hiding under the table.
Plus, the world reacts to the killing of aid workers in Gaza.
We were outraged to learn of an IDF strike that killed a number of civilian humanitarian workers yesterday from the World Central Kitchen, which has been relentless in working to get food to those who are hungry in Gaza and, quite frankly, around the world.
And later, U.S.-China relations, an update from Kyiv, and the latest from Thailand. Today is Wednesday, April 3rd, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. The world is still reeling from Tuesday's news of the 7 aid workers from the World Central Kitchen who were killed in Gaza. We'll have an update in a few minutes. Starting us off today, though, is the news of a powerful earthquake in Taiwan, the biggest one there in 25 years. Reuters' Diane To gets us up to speed.
Eyewitness video captured the moment a powerful earthquake hit Taiwan on Wednesday at a magnitude of 7.2, according to local authorities, the strongest tremor to rock the island in at least 25 years. It left several people dead and injured hundreds more, with local TV stations airing footage of a building half collapsed in the eastern area of Hualien. Firefighters rushed to rescue people from the damaged building. The quake struck just offshore from Hualien around 8 a.m. as people were going to work and school. It also triggered huge landslides and sparked a tsunami warning briefly for the island, as well as southern Japan and the Philippines. Taiwan authorities said they registered more than 25 aftershocks, with witnesses saying tremors could still be felt in Taipei later in the day. Residents in the northern capital city described the moment the quake hit.
It was shaking very violently. All the motorcycles outside our house toppled over, so I quickly switched off the gas and the electrical source and opened the main door.
It was shaking like this quite strongly. Maybe an earthquake hasn't happened in a long time, so it felt really terrifying.
The Taipei City government said it had not received any reports of major damage, and the city's metro was up and running soon after the tremor. Electricity operator Tai Power said some 87,000 households in Taiwan were without power as of early afternoon. It also said that the quake did not affect the country's two nuclear power stations. Taiwan's high-speed rail operator said no damage or injuries were reported on its trains, but noted that service would be delayed while it carried out inspections. It's the biggest earthquake to hit the island since 1999, according to the government-backed Central News Agency, when a 7.6 magnitude tremor killed around 2,400 people.
That's Diane To of Reuters reporting for us today. And for our personal account of what it was like to experience the quake, and for the absolute latest news, I spoke with VOA's William Yang in Taipei.
As we know so far, unfortunately, 9 people have died and more than 900 people have been injured. And we are expecting the number of injury to go up as the day drags on. And basically, most of the casualties and the death are concentrated in the Hualien County on the East Coast. We are hearing dozens of buildings in the county have already partially collapsed or even completely collapsed. And major roads, railways leading into that county have mostly been severely damaged. And so far, the government is trying to arrange air traffic and also sea traffic to try to basically transport people who need to leave that part of Taiwan to other parts of Taiwan.
Now, you were in Taipei. What did it feel like for you?
So in the morning, it basically felt like a much longer, much stronger earthquake than the ones that we usually get here. It started shaking left and right first, and then it started shaking a little bit up and down. It lasted much longer, almost 2 minutes, and things started falling off the shelves in my apartment. So I immediately practiced the protocol of hiding under the table. And then in between the first and the second earthquake, I had to go over and open the door of my apartment because I live on the 8th floor of a very, very big apartment complex. It's almost impossible to immediately find the window of time to actually get down from the eighth floor to the first floor.
And what have you heard from friends, neighbors, family in the area?
So luckily, people in the capital city of Taipei largely are safe. There's very limited injuries or also damages to buildings that have been reported. But sources and connections in the eastern county of Hualien have said and reported back that a lot of the buildings and have been seriously damaged, and a lot of them are stuck in hospitals that are full of injured people. One of my connection and friend, in fact, hurt his feet while trying to escape and is now requiring to stay in the hospital for a few days because of the injury that he sustained.
Approximately 25 years ago, there was a similarly powerful earthquake in which thousands of people were killed in Taiwan. How is that quake different from this one? Why such a high death toll then and not now?
I think a couple differences come to mind. The number one difference is that this time the epicenter is off the coast of Taiwan. It's not directly under the Taiwan Main Island. Back 25 years ago, the earthquake was in fact in right in the middle of Taiwan. And because this particular earthquake that take place today is much shallower, the level of the shockwave is also less. I think that's why we are seeing that most of the major damages and casualties are taking place mostly restricted to Hualien County. And I think the experience from 25 years ago really forced Taiwan to learn from the lessons and improve the, I think, durability of the buildings and build up a system to periodically check on the durability of the building, including the materials that are used to build it. And there are certain standards that buildings need to follow. And also, of course, it's like the national warning system, the national rescue system, and how to mobilize and activate different resources when needed. So I think all these experiences adding up together allowed Taiwan today, in particular, to be able to respond to the earthquake and the damages that followed in such a systematic way.
Well, certainly a bit of good news to come out of this then, that the country was able to learn from the last one.
Right, indeed.
VOA's William Yang is in Taipei. William, thank you for your time today. Thanks for your reporting.
Thank you so much.
And having nothing to do with the earthquake, Taiwan is still on a lot of minds here in Washington. On a call just yesterday, President Joe Biden discussed with Chinese President Xi Jinping a range of high-level issues, including the status of Taiwan as it prepares to inaugurate a new leader next month. Biden also reiterated his request that China not use web-based disinformation tools to interfere with the U.S. presidential election. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Washington.
The White House described Tuesday's phone call between President Joe Biden and Chinese leader Xi Jinping, which follows their in-person meeting last year, as candid and constructive. This time, the two covered a range of issues they had previously discussed in November, including joint counter-narcotics efforts, military communication, and the risks of artificial intelligence. John Kirby is White House National Security Communications Advisor.
We believe that there is no substitute for regular communication at the leader level to effectively manage this complex and often tense bilateral relationship. And both presidents agreed to pick up the phone and speak when needed.
Xi, in a statement, said both leaders found the phone call to be candid and constructive. But he stressed that disagreements remain, notably about the status of Taiwan, which China claims. In his statement, Xi said the China-U.S. relationship is beginning to stabilize, and this is welcomed by both societies and the international community. On the other hand, the negative factors of the relationship have also been growing, and this requires attention from both sides. The White House said Biden reiterated, but did not advance, previous concerns about Chinese interference in the upcoming U.S. election. Xi did not mention the topic in his account of the call. Kirby again.
I would just say that we've been clear consistently, even going back to the November meeting in California, about our concerns over our own election security and efforts by certain actors, including some from the PRC, to affect that.
Just last month, the British Parliament voted to impose sanctions over Beijing-linked hacks of its Electoral Commission and Parliament. U.S. intelligence officials have also warned lawmakers that Chinese hackers are preparing to wreak havoc and cause real-world harm to the U.S. China's government last month showcased how it uses digital tools to bolster, not hamper, democracy. But analysts point to a state-sponsored Chinese influence campaign known as Spamouflage that does the opposite and encouraged Biden to push back. Max Lesser is a senior analyst on emerging threats at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies.
There needs to be a very clear and consistent communication about election interference. And I don't just mean hacking into voting systems, which in itself is obviously one of the most heavy-handed forms of election interference, but even the ones that involve manipulating public opinion in deceptive ways, or even just trying to discourage people from voting, which we have seen from operations that have been linked to China in the past.
The White House did not say when the two leaders would next speak, but Xi, in his statement, said he welcomed this week's visit to China by U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen. Anita Powell, VOA News, Washington.
And now to Gaza and the world's central kitchen workers who were killed by an Israeli strike. White House National Security Council spokesman John Kirby says the U.S. is outraged to have learned of the strike and called on Israel to do much more so that civilians and humanitarian aid workers are protected. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports from the State Department.
White House National Security spokesman John Kirby had this reaction during Tuesday's press briefing.
We were outraged to learn of an IDF strike that killed a number of civilian humanitarian workers yesterday from the World Central Kitchen, which has been relentless in working to get food to those who are hungry in Gaza and, quite frankly, around the world.
World Central Kitchen is run by celebrity chef Jose Andres. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre said President Joe Biden reached out to Andres.
The president conveyed he is grieving with the entire World Central Kitchen family. The president felt it was important to recognize the tremendous contribution World Central Kitchen has made to the people in Gaza and people around the world. The president conveyed he will make clear to Israel that humanitarian aid workers must be protected.
Standing with his French counterpart on a visit to Paris, Secretary of State Antony Blinken called the aid workers heroes who must be protected.
We've spoken directly to the Israeli government about this particular incident. We've urged a swift, a thorough, and impartial investigation to understand exactly what happened.
French Foreign Minister Stéphane Séjourné was more direct in condemning the Israeli strike.
Allow me first of all to express our strong condemnation of the Israeli strike that led to the deaths of seven humanitarian workers from the NGO World Central Kitchen. Protecting humanitarian workers is a moral and legal imperative that everyone must adhere to.
Israel's military on Tuesday expressed sincere sorrow over the airstrike and said officials are reviewing the incident at the highest levels. Relief experts say Palestinian children and families are on the brink of starvation, and this attack will only make things worse. Cindy Sain, VOA News, the State Department.
Meanwhile, some of the bodies of the WCK workers are on their way home today. They were taken from a hospital morgue near Rafah to be sent on to their homelands on Wednesday. Marwan Al-Hams is the director of the hospital.
On this day, as we bid farewell to martyrs of foreign nationalities, three martyrs of the humanitarian duty of British nationality, one American, one Australian, and one Polish. This is a sign that the weapons provided by the British and American governments in support of the Israeli occupation army in weapons, money, and equipment do not differentiate between Palestinians and other nationalities.
There has been international outrage at the aid worker deaths. U.S. President Joe Biden said Tuesday he was outraged and heartbroken, and he called on Israel to do more to protect humanitarian workers. Israel said it mistakenly killed the aid workers and promised a full investigation. You're listening to Flashpoint, Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. We'll check in with Kyiv in just a moment, but now a little more on the humanitarian situation in Gaza following the deaths of the seven aid workers from the World Central Kitchen. While the WCK is pausing its vital work in Gaza because of the tragedy, how are other aid groups reacting, and will more of them also feel it's too dangerous for their staffs? VOA's Lori London talked about it with Bushra Khalidi. She's Oxfam's policy lead in Ramallah.
Since the onset of the offensive, we've seen a systematic disregard for humanitarian aid efforts, aid workers, relief workers. We've just seen an unprecedented assault on the humanitarian efforts as a whole, with Israeli authorities systematically and knowingly striking locations provided by humanitarian teams for aid delivery and assistance. So our reaction is that it's clear our position remains the same. No one is safe, and nowhere is safe in Gaza, and no one is safe in Gaza. And Israel has to stop its egregious and its systematic and continuous violations of international law.
What happens now if aid groups just feel they can't take the risk?
We've been operating in Gaza, and most INGOs and local partners that we work through, trusted local partners that we work through, we've been operating together and working together for, I would say, since 1956 for Oxfam. And we work with local communities. Like, our staff are local staff. They are from the community, and they are right now not only working as relief workers and aid workers, but they're also serving the communities and trying to look for their next meal. And so, of course, operating in that space is so scary. And working in the occupied Palestinian territory generally is a scary place. I am even scared to drive outside of the city of Ramallah because of settler violence, because of the checkpoints, because, you know, the tension is here is palpable as well. So we know we choose to work in a very high-risk context. I applaud my colleagues in Gaza for their heroic effort in the last 6 months. But it also has impact. So, for example, one day we had to deliver fruit and vegetables to a community, and our partners could not go and deliver that day because of the bombardments and the airstrikes that were happening in the area. And all that food went to waste. And so this is what's happening. Without a ceasefire, we can't really operate in the way that we would want to. We're doing what we can. We're trying to get as much aid as we can, but a lot of it is also rejected by Israeli authorities. We're beyond just trying to get food into Gaza right now. We need to remove the rubble so that we can have roads that we can drive on. So it's an impossible situation. I cannot describe in enough words of how difficult the situation is and how there are easy fixes and easy solutions if Israel would agree. And if, of course, Israel's allies would put enough pressure, because, you know, statements are no longer enough. We need action.
Are you hearing from any colleagues, organizations actually now at the point where they're not certain they can continue or will continue?
World Central Kitchen has said that it will pause its operations. Right. And other organizations from the existing humanitarian country team, it's a conversation we're having, Lori. Of course, we're having this conversation because we have a duty of care to our colleagues and to our staff. And we need to act in a principled way as humanitarians. We abide by international law in relation to our own staff. And we have a real duty of care to them, and we owe them that. So, of course, it's a conversation that we have with our colleagues in Gaza, because at the end of the day, they are the ones that can inform us best on what decisions to make. And of course, the incident is not an isolated one. So this is a risk we have known. And yet our teams have continued to insist, and our partners that are the ones that are on the ground in the field, visiting the communities, who know the communities, who have said, we want to continue working as long as there's aid here, as long as that we can do something, we want to continue doing what we're doing. But of course, the situation is so ever evolving that it might change, and we might have to rethink our strategy.
Lori London is the host of Issues in the News here on The Voice of America. She was speaking with Bushra Khalidi, the policy lead for Oxfam in Ramallah. Switching gears now to Ukraine, where 18 people were injured, including 5 children. This after Russian forces launched a missile attack on the city of Dnipro. Meanwhile, Ukraine's Minister of Foreign Affairs began his 2-day visit to NATO headquarters in Brussels. VOA correspondent Anna Chernikova has the details from Kyiv.
Late in the afternoon on April 2nd, Russian forces launched a missile attack on the city of Dnipro. 18 people were injured, including 5 children who were hospitalized. Heavy damage to a kindergarten, a sports school, and a local business were reported. The head of the Dnipropetrovsk Regional Military Administration, Sergei Lysak, said the sports school is a place where many Ukrainian sports stars have been training for over 40 years, including those who will represent Ukraine at the Olympic Games this year. Representatives of the school said that there were students there during the explosion and that they were saved by the fact that they followed the safety rules and went down to the shelter. sports teacher Yevhen Proshenko.
Our school is famous for its discipline. Our priority is that the children behave well, and only then comes sport. Our leadership always made the 500 children that were here go to the shelter during air raid alerts, and God saved us from a big tragedy with us.
Meanwhile, Dmytro Kuleba, the Minister of Foreign Affairs of Ukraine, began his two-day visit to the NATO headquarters in Brussels, with bilateral talks scheduled for Wednesday. Kuleba will meet with EU High Representative of the European Union for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy, Joseph Borrell, as well as the foreign ministers of Britain, Denmark, Spain, Poland, Finland, Estonia, Bulgaria, Greece, Hungary, and New Zealand. On Thursday, a meeting of the Ukraine NATO Council is scheduled. Kuleba will hold talks with the foreign ministers of Italy and Sweden, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, and NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg. The main topic of the meetings will include President Zelensky's peace formula, the use of frozen Russian assets for Ukraine's needs, and other urgent topics. On April 2nd, Kuleba visited The Hague, where he held a number of meetings and participated in a conference on ensuring the punishment for Russia for crimes committed in the war against Ukraine. Also on Tuesday, President Zelensky signed two bills aiming to improve military mobilization strategy in Ukraine. The first bill on lowering the age for mobilization to increase the number of potential troops. The second bill is for creating an electronic register for conscripts. This will allow Ukrainian authorities to have a single database, which will be updated automatically without the need for physical visits to the recruitment centers. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
And finally today, on Wednesday, Thailand's Constitutional Court accepted a case that could dissolve the popular opposition Move Forward party. It's another blow for the anti-establishment movement trying to push major institutional reforms in the country. Reuters' Olivia Chan has more.
Thailand's opposition Move Forward party suffered a major setback on Wednesday. The country's constitutional court accepted a case filed by the Electoral Commission seeking to disband it over a controversial campaign to reform a law that shields the powerful monarchy from criticism. The law carries a punishment of up to 15 years jail for each perceived insult of the royal family. The palace typically does not comment on the law, which is among the strictest of its kind in the world. Wednesday's ruling is another blow for the popular anti-establishment movement pushing for major institutional reforms, and follows a January ruling by the same court that found Move Forward's plan to amend the law was unconstitutional and tantamount to an attempt to overthrow the system of government with the king as head of state. Move Forward has denied that was its intention. A spokesperson for the party said on Wednesday that it would prepare its defense and was ready for all scenarios. The party pulled off a stunning feat by winning last year's election, but it was blocked from forming a government by lawmakers with the royalist military. Move Forward is the biggest party in the lower house with about 30% of seats. Recent polls show it is still Thailand's most popular party. Its progressive platform resonated among young and urban voters with its reform agenda, which threatened to upend Thailand's conservative status quo. Move Forward's leader Peter Lim Jeronrat in February told Reuters his party would fight tooth and nail for its future.
That's Olivia Chan of Reuters reporting for us today. And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com. and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with a 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.